At the August 2022 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society, Dr. Helen Belcher, co-chair of the Maitland-Newcastle Diocesan Pastoral Council, presented a reflection entitled Walking the Synodal Path of the Fifth Plenary Council of Australia. Dr. Belcher's 40 slides containing related texts and images are also downloadable from the ACHS website. The Society's President, Dr. John Carmody, opened the meeting by first acknowledging the prior custodianship by our First Nations people of the place where we met and all the places in Australia where this podcast may be heard. He then encouraged attendees to reflect upon the Uluru Statement from the Heart, copies of which were provided. We join the meeting as the President introduces our speaker.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Helen Belcher, who's going to be talking to us today on that recently completed and rather erratically reported event. So today we're going to have the insights and experience, personal experience of somebody who was actually there. Helen is an academic, a retired academic with interests in health, sociology, health policy and community engagement. She has a long and distinguished record of activity. It's exhausting to read it. In the health and educational life of the Hunter Valley where she lives, she's had all sorts of school and health appointments in that area, and I won't go into them, except to say that her church activities have included a term as co-chair of the Council for Mission in the Diocesan Council for the Diocese of Maitland-Newcastle, which was dismissed on the death of Bishop Bill Wright. It's a great pleasure and privilege to have you talk to us today on your topic, which is the Fifth Plenary Council in Australia.
Thank you, John, and thank you for having me today. It's probably worth saying that this is Michael and mine first visit back to the society post-COVID. So it's been a while since we've been here, and I'm coming to talk to you today. I too acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting today, and like John, I share that acknowledgement to countries elsewhere. We actually come from Wanneroo country. I also extend that respect to any Aboriginal peoples that might be present today. I have to say I was a little bit taken aback when John asked me to speak on this topic. I'm not an historian, nor am I a theologian. But I am, I suppose, an active Catholic within my own area, and I was privileged to be asked by Bishop Bill to be one of the members of the Plenary Council from the Diocese of Maitland-Newcastle. I want to actually pay my respects to Bill. He had an unusual way of operating, but in the end, he allowed things to happen in our diocese that have been of benefit to our diocese. And one of the decisions that he made when the appointment of members for the Plenary Council was that he would appoint two women, because there were two men already, so that there was to be him and the Vicar General. So it was his decision that he needed to balance that. Unfortunately, Bill took sick and was unable to attend the first session of this, the Plenary Council, and he died in between. I think in some ways our diocese was quite blessed because of that decision to have equal representation, because I know that that hasn't been the experience across Australia. So in agreeing to talk today, I explained to John that probably what I would best do would be to give a reflection on the Plenary Council journey from my perspective. It's a bit difficult trying to work out where to start from, because if you look at the, just to pick up on John's comment about the coverage across Australia around the Plenary Council, it wasn't really well documented or well known. And I think that that is true amongst Catholics as well. So I have made the decision today to start from the position that people may not know a lot about the plenary council. And I hope that that's not an insult to your intelligence, because I know some people are well versed in it, others maybe not so well versed. I'm also aware that there are quite a few commentaries that have already been written around the plenary council, some very good commentaries, and I'm sure in the not too distant future there'll be some academic papers around the council as well. So with your indulgence, I'm going to walk the synodal path of the fifth plenary council. I decided to start with the logo for the council. And you might see that it's made up of a lot of boxes with the cross in the middle. Essentially, what it's embodying is that the plenary council was about listening to a community of communities, united in faith, guided by the Spirit, in order to discern what God was asking of us at this time. So the way that I'm going to undertake this journey is to follow roughly this outline. So what is synodality? What is a synod, and how does it differ from a plenary council? And the reason that I've put that in is because I think that that's an important thing that I will come back to at the end of my talk. I want to travel the journey. I'd like to reflect on the process. I've put implementation after that because we're moving into that stage. And then I'm going to ask that question, was the plenary council a success? And look at some, what from my perspective are some challenges and learnings before I make a final comment. What I can say is that in actually putting together this paper, I was bowled over by the complexity of the journey. And I was living the journey. I was an active member in the process. But when I started to look at it, I was very much struck by how much actually went in to making this a success. So synodality, we've heard a lot about synodality over the last few years, and it's really about mutual listening. I know that there's some contestation around this, but this is my understanding. It's about mutual listening. It's about understanding that everyone has something to learn, the lay faithful, the bishops, and the Pope. Importantly, it's about all listening to each other and listening to the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth. And the purpose of this is in order to know what God is saying to us, what God is asking of us. You'd be well aware that Pope Francis has turbocharged the whole idea of synodality. And he very much argues that it's the constituent element of the church, and it's to be found at all levels of church life. I recently read a report of his talk to the Jesuits in Canada at the end of his visit to Canada. And he expressed some frustration with the use of the word synodal in front of church. The point that he was making is the church is either synodal or it is not. It's not church. So in other words, synodality and church are very much linked. So put simply, synodality is about journeying together by listening to the Holy Spirit and to each other to discern what God is asking of us. So if I now just spend a little bit of time talking about synods and plenary councils. So synods are gatherings or assemblies, traditionally of bishops. It comes from the Greek word synodos, meaning assembly, whose purpose is to discern a way or a direction. They're not new, and you'd be well aware of that. Dates back to probably even before this, to the Council of Jerusalem. The Council of Trent talked about annual synods. The 1917 Code legislated for a synod every 10 years. But Vatican II desired that the venerable institution of synods and councils flourish with fresh vigour. Importantly, they stressed that they should be more dialogic and participatory. And that tied up with the idea that because of our baptism, all of us have a part of the truth. All of us have a sense of the faith, the senses for day. And together, the church together, the people of God, has the faithful sense of the faith. So in other words, there is something to be learned from all of us. In 65, Pope Paul VI instituted the Synod of Bishops, which was about collegiality between the Pope and bishops. And they're now held every couple of years. So most recently, you'd be well aware that we're also undertaking a journey of synodality for the Universal Church, and that's the Synod of the Bishops on Synodality. To go back to this point, the Church and synods are synonymous. So a plenary council is also a gathering, but it's a gathering of a particular territory along with of bishops of a particular territory along with a number of priests and others who may be invited. And they've been called together to consider matters of importance by the church or for the church in that particular territory, and most importantly, to pass legislation. Any such legislation must first be approved by the Holy See. So the Synod and a plenary council both can be influential. But importantly, the plenary council is the highest form of gathering and has that legislative and governance authority. Its decisions are binding on the particular territory. So in our case, the decisions made by the plenary council are binding on the church in Australia. A synod doesn't have this legislative function, but it can provide direction, and it is important. They are important. You might recall that Pope Francis has talked about the epoch of change. And in his speech on the 50th anniversary of the Synod of Bishops in 2015, he made this particular point. We cannot simply wait for what we are experiencing to pass under the illusion that things will return to how they were before. So he's calling us to be considerate of how we might live in the world at this particular point of time, not harking back to previous times. So the Australian response was the convocation, or one of the responses, was the convocation of the Fifth Plenary Council. In talking about the Plenary Council, Mark Coleridge made this comment: "The church is not the present in our society it once was. We need to take a measure of that and make decisions accordingly. The culture in which we have to proclaim the gospel is very different to what it was 20 or 30 years ago." So that's a huge challenge for the church in Australia. We have to be mindful of the signs of the times and work out how we're actually going to live with those signs. What's interesting about the calling of the plenary council was it had quite a significant length of time as part of its gestation. So in effect, it probably started in 2012 with the Year of Grace, which was about holding a year to discern the need for a national gathering. Now, I'm not arguing that it started in 2012 because I believe some of the bishops were already talking about the need to actually come together as a national church. But in 2012, there was a year to discern the need for a national gathering. The actual decision to hold the council wasn't made till May 2016, and it was a response to the invitation from the Pope for local churches to dialogue with their constituents. it was to address the significant changes in society that Francis spoke about and Mark Coleridge spoke about. Importantly, it was to listen and respond to the Royal Commission into institutional abuse and the role of the Catholic Church in that particular scandal. It was also about dialoguing about the future of the Catholic Church in Australia. So the decisions made in 2016 wasn't ratified by Pope Francis until March of 2018. It was launched on Pentecost of 2020 and officially convoked on the Feast of Pentecost in 2021. And in July of this year, we concluded with the second assembly of the Plenary Council. Not only was the gestation long, but the journey of the actual council, the business of the actual councils, has also taken place over several years. So there have been three distinct phases. There was a preparation phase, and that had two aspects to it. The first was listening and dialogue, and the second was listening and discernment. There was a celebration phase, and that's the two assemblies and the period between the assemblies. And the third stage is the implementation, which is about the promulgation of the decrees. And that's in transit. I've just put that up to just talk about, just to show that the various stages in this particular phase. You probably can't see it very well, but you can see that there are lots of aspects to it. So listening and dialogue. So this period invited the people of God in Australia to consider, to discern, to provide reflections either as groups or individuals around these three questions. What do you think God is asking of us in Australia at this time? What questions do you have about the future of the church in Australia that you would like the Plenary Council to consider? And the third part was that you were invited to share your story about your experience of faith shared in Australia. Now, one of the features of the assembly from the start, from the council from the start, has been about the use of a spiritual conversations. And the spiritual conversation started really early in the piece. They were about asking people to reflect on the basis of their prayers, what the message was, then reflecting again to ask and to consider what the group was saying, and then finally coming to a decision or an action. I have to say, that particular way of operating is pretty foreign to Catholics in Australia. It's pretty foreign to me. So when I started out on this journey, this was a particular learning path that I embarked upon. And I have to say now, I'm quite a convert to this way of working. So one of the challenges, I think, for us in Australia is how do we embed spiritual conversations in our communities so that people can listen, dialogue, and discern. So the spiritual conversations were actually about discerning lived and historical experience, the current reality of the church in Australia, and importantly, the hopes, the questions, and the yearnings that challenge us as church in Australia. Out of that phase came this report, Listen to What the Spirit is Saying. So it was the final report of this listening and dialogue phase. I'm going to come back and make a few more comments later, but I'm just going through this chronology at the moment. This stretched to 300 pages, this report. And on top of that, the team that were tasked with compiling the report also produced reports for each diocese. So this was a huge exercise, a mammoth task. The document is rich and invites ongoing reflection. It's available on the web if you haven't seen it, but if you just want to dip your toes into it, it is quite a significant document. Out of that phase, we got the six national themes for discernment. So those themes are missionary and evangelising, inclusive, participatory and synodal, prayerful and eucharistic, humble, healing and merciful, a joyful, hope-filled servant community, open to conversion, renewal and reform. So these themes then became the focus of phase two, which was about listening and discernment. So again, you can see that there's quite extensive planning going into this particular phase. I'll share a story. In our diocese, when these themes came out, as part of our own synod, we embarked on a listening and discernment process around these six themes. What was really interesting is one of the members of our synod or our gathering asked the question, why aren't we these things? So what is it that we have been doing wrong that these have emerged as areas that we need to address? I think that's a particularly relevant question. What is it that the church in Australia or the church in the Diocese of Maitland, Newcastle, that it's not joyful, merciful, Eucharistic, prayerful? So there's significant questions that I think as church we need to address. So out of the discernment phase around those six themes, I want to make a couple of points. The listening to the Spirit was continuing, a very key component, but it was about communal discernment around the six themes rather than individual. Now, that didn't mean you couldn't embark on individual discernment, but it was essentially the emphasis was on communal discernment. Again, spiritual conversations, but this time we're talking about let's pray together, let's reflect together, let's share and listen. Then we need to think locally and to think nationally and then reach some sort of a decision. It's quite an extended period of time, roughly 2 to 2.5 hours, and the number of participants suggested was 10 to 12. And it was also important to have an area where you could be quiet in terms of that reflection. So anywhere quiet. There were lots of fruits coming out of this whole council process. And the fruits to emerge from the discernment around the six themes were these two documents. The Instrumentum Laboris, which was published in February of 2021, and the agenda for the first assembly. And you can see it identifies six key areas. So one of the things that I had to keep reminding myself was I talking about 6, 4, 8 themes because they kept changing as they were further refined. So to move to the celebration phase of the plenary council journey, the first cab off the rank was the actual first assembly. And this was the logo that that accompanied this particular assembly. COVID wreaked havoc. We were to gather in face-to-face in Adelaide, but because of the impact of COVID, the whole timeline changed, and the first assembly was delayed until of October of 2021, and it was agreed that it would be a virtual experience. This is uncharted territory, having an assembly this size, to try and actually come to some meaningful decisions. It was virtual. It addressed 16 questions. And what I've noted there is the number of questions against each of those themes, and I'm not going to read them out at this particular point of time. Approximately 280 members gathered virtually. There are also staff and facilitators as well, and theologians, so that wasn't the complete extent, but 280 members. The way they managed the process was we were divided up into 10 groups of approximately 30 people per group. Those groups were broken down into three smaller groups of roughly 10 people when it came to the first and second stages of the spiritual conversations. Each of the groups had one question to address, one of those 16, which in fact turned out to be 14, one of those 14 questions, but some groups had two questions to deal with. And that was a bit of a problem because the groups that had two questions, and I was one of those groups, meant that our time around the question was a bit constrained because we needed to deal with the two questions. The two questions, the one around the wounds of abuse and the needs of the most vulnerable, were actually part of a special plenary session where all the members gathered to deal with those two particular questions. As I've noted, we used spiritual conversations. We were learning spiritual conversations, so sometimes we didn't quite get that right, and facilitators actually helped us to finesse that process. Importantly, it was about acknowledgement of country. It was about liturgy and daily masses. And the other feature were interventions. Now, I had an issue with interventions, not because they weren't profound or they didn't have something to offer, but it was how you actually use interventions at the appropriate time so that they're contributing to the discussion, not as a distraction from the discussion. I don't believe I was alone in having that thought. The document that came out of that particular assembly was this one, the first assembly proposals from small groups and individual members. And the other thing that became clear is people or members didn't fully understand when they could actually submit a proposal. So some people were very cluey and got proposals in, others weren't as cluey. So that was a bit of a flaw in the process as well. But nevertheless, another significant document of around 110 pages. So between the assemblies, we went through this particular process. The drafting committee took all the material from the previous phases, plus the proposals coming from the first assembly, and they distilled it into this document towards the second assembly working document for members. It was released in February of 2022. Significantly, it was only released to members. And at this stage, the drafting groups distill the information into four thematic foci. Deeper communion enriched by diversity, and really about participation. Ecclesial leadership and governance, growing as disciples and servants of the gospel. To witness to faith, hope and love as missionary disciples in the world. And to proclaim God's new creation as a people of prayer, healing and hope. Reconciliation, compassion for the wounded and care for our common home. This is where time got really tight because we were required to have responses back to the drafting team by the 4th of April. I think it's amazing that people took the time to provide 535 responses in that period of time. Not everybody responded, and some people responded with several responses. Out of that came the framework for motions. Members were invited again to suggest recommendations for amendments, resulting in the final motions and amendment document that became the agenda, and that was released at the end of May. Over June, we had a series of coffee conversations about various matters related to the council, to this, the motions document, to organisational matters, and also just refreshing in spiritual conversations. So we got to the second part of the celebration stage, the second assembly, held between the 3rd and the 9th of July this year. If you've had a look at the frameworks document, the motions and amendments document, you'll notice it's divided into 8 parts. So we've gone from 6, 4, now to 8 parts. And the drafting team is working all the time to actually finesse this. These were the basis of the motions that were put to the assembly. In addition, there were 3 further parts, and I've just added those in because they were really about the workings or the business of the assembly. So the implementation phase, the decrees, and the closing of the council. So all up, there are 10 parts to the document. At the second assembly, there were approximately 277 members, 30-plus tables of approximately 8 people per table, and each table had at least one bishop, maybe a couple of clergy and a couple of lay people and maybe religious from across Australia. Each day opened with the acknowledgement of country and liturgy. We had discernment on the motions based on spiritual conversations. There was input from the pariti. Voting was a mixture of online, straw polling, pen and paper. So the weather was atrocious. I actually bought gumboots to try and walk between the hotel and St Mary's. It really was atrocious. But the sun finally appeared at the end of the assembly. The other significant aspect of it was COVID. And if you didn't catch COVID while you're in the assembly, you got it when you got home. And I was one of those. I got it when I got home. So fortunately, I made the end of the assembly. There were more than 35 motions put to a consultative and deliberative vote. 3 failed. 4.5 and 4.6, the ones around the dignity of women, but they were subsequently redrafted and passed. And the other one that failed was 5.4 on lay ministry of preaching in Eucharistic assemblies. The voting is actually also on the web if you're interested in looking at how it went. The votes were taken after the spiritual conversations. They had to receive a qualified majority vote from the deliberative voters, that is the bishops, in order to be passed. They were confirmed as decrees. And in November of this year, the ACBC will send those decrees to Rome for review. Only after they come back from Rome will they be promulgated. I'm just going to note a couple of the motions here. So the specific motions around part one was really the acceptance and acknowledgement of First Nations people. So we endorsed and embraced the NATSIC recommendations to the council. In part two, it was the apology to victims of abuse, their families and their communities. There were commitments to education, health and social justice and ecumenical relationships in part three. Part four was about support for the equal dignity of men and women, and I'll just come back to that, so I won't spend a bit of time here. Part five was the review of guidelines for lay people in the participate in preaching. Part six talked about support for ministry and leadership. Seven talked about the establishment of pastoral councils and finance councils. And part eight was about the institution of action plans around Laudato Si by every parish, diocese and agency within the church. So to come back to some reflections. In terms of the first phase, over 222,000 people made responses to the plenary council, and that was contained in nearly 18,000 submissions. The submissions were wide-ranging and they were diverse and contained conflicting views. There are concerns about several areas, and to just pick out a couple of those, it's about the roles of the laity, women and young people. There were concerns about the viability of parishes, engagement with the clergy and governance, and there are also concerns about the impact of COVID, to mention a few. What this phase revealed, the ongoing pain and trauma from the abuse scandal, it revealed the cultural diversity of the church in Australia. It also revealed the depth of people's commitment to the church. And there was also applause for the good works being done. The other thing that I thought was of value is it exposed people to the use of spiritual conversations. It was a mammoth exercise, and I actually think it was amazing that actually it produced that response. In terms of the first assembly, again, the genuine concern for the church was visible, was palpable. There was the commitment of the members to hear and to listen to each other. It recognised our cultural diversity, and it also recognised the openness of members to listen to the voice of the Holy Spirit. In terms of the process, the questions appeared to be unfocused, but in the end, they did allow for wide-ranging discussion, and I would argue that all issues were covered in some way. The other thing about the process, it was exhausting. In fact, I felt like I had jet lag when the week finished, because essentially we were on the computers the whole week. Some improvements would be to get the balance between small group and individual proposals, which I mentioned earlier, identifying the purpose of interventions, and the other thing was the virtual process did work, but we missed out on the incidental meetings, so the discussions over morning tea, etc., and time was a factor. Between assemblies, we had the opportunity to provide feedback. We had the opportunity to provide, to listen and participate in coffee conversations, so it kept the ball rolling. But again, time was an impediment, and the other difficulty was we had limited or no time to discuss the proposals with a wider audience. Day three was the turning point for the assembly. On Tuesday, motion 4.5 received a qualified majority of the consultative vote. Motion 4.6 failed. The next day, because the bishops voted on the motions the next day, both those motions failed. So before morning tea on Wednesday, we faced a situation where the assembly looked as though it would have nothing to say about the participation of women in the church. Now, for those of you who have followed the live streaming and some of the coverage, you would have seen the palpable hurt. There were tears, there was anger, there was frustration. I think I'm a bit long in the tooth, because on Tuesday I'd got to the stage, I thought, well, here we go again. But on day when the bishops voted, I thought, you know, that would be addressed. When the motions didn't pass, that undid me. It undid a lot of people. So over morning tea, there was much angst, and people came back from morning tea, and some women had gathered at the back of the hall, and as we walked into the hall, they invited us to participate in a protest. I joined that protest. It was completely spontaneous, despite some of the reports that you may have seen in the media. It was spontaneous and it was organic. The bishops have come under quite a deal of attack for the failure of those particular motions. And in fact, if you look at the vote, it wasn't that the majority of bishops weren't supportive, but about 20, I've gotten the figures, quite a significant number of the bishops voted yes. About another six voted placet juxtamodum, with reservation. And then a lesser number of people voted non-place. So it could be argued that if those ones that were with reservations had made a decision, then they would have probably passed. The other reason... I actually think that the bishops have been a bit hard done by, because the consultative vote the day before wasn't conclusive either. It got the two-thirds majority for one of the motions but failed on the other. So it can be really argued that what the consultative voters were doing was sending a message to the bishops that we hadn't quite got it right. For me, this was clear evidence of the spirit at work. To give credit where it's due, the steering committee met, regrouped, referred to the statutes, and we agreed as an assembly to revisit this particular part of the agenda. And ultimately, I believe that we've ended up with a better paper. And all those motions passed. There were two other fruits that I thought, and I'm not alone in this, and this has been, you can see that the Archbishop Costello's concluding statements also refers to this. There was a change of process that worked better, and there was a change in atmosphere and tone. And that carried over into the rest of the assembly. So in the end, that protest, that disruption, the spirit of disruption, was a positive outcome for the assembly. So there are some other benefits. Not the least was the participation and embracing of First Nations spirituality. This here was a message stick that was presented to Archbishop Costello and the plenary assembly on behalf of the Kimberley First Nations people. It was a beautiful, moving ceremony and a beautiful message stick. The First Nations people also led a really meaningful liturgy. Other benefits were the prayers and support that we received throughout the assembly from people outside of us. There was the apology to the victims of abuse, the response to the vulnerable, the concern for the environment. Significantly, it was a gathering of bishops, clergy, religious, lay men and women. It wasn't just the bishops or clergy. And it was also important from the input from the Pariti, and we had some excellent presentations each day from one of those people. And I suppose the other I've already referred to was the flexibility of the organising team to manage that disruption on day three. So the implementation is what I've referred to the symphony in the making. So this is about the promulgation of the decrees. It's a signal to local churches as well as the national, that we have a role to play. We can't just rely on the ACBC to do something. And significantly, there's an expectation that each diocese will present a report, the first in 2023, the second in 2025, and a final report in 2027. So was the plenary a success? If we go back to the idea that a plenary is about legislation, then there wasn't a lot of legislation that came out of the plenary. So to that extent, you would have to argue that the plenary was limited. But as a synod, I think it worked brilliantly because it started with the listening and dialogue, it identified key themes, and it gathered to address these issues and suggest ways forward. I think that there are many pluses that can be celebrated, but I think that there are also some challenges. Some things weren't addressed. How will we manage these issues? Different opinions remain. How do we actually bridge that gap? How do we achieve unity in diversity? Will we achieve consistency of practice across the nation? How will we support dioceses that don't actually have the resources or the personnel to continue their work? And finally, for me, is that how do we embed spiritual conversations in the way we operate, in everything that we do as church, business as well as pastoral matters? I thought that there were several learnings, and I think I've already referred to those in some way, but I will actually highlight the importance of listening to First Nations people and the value that that provides us. To go back, as John talked about the Uluru Statement of the Heart, that was a key feature of the First Assembly too. But one of the significant things that I think about the development of that particular statement was the process that they undertook. And that was about listening, dialogue, discerning, which is exactly what synodality is about. I think we've got much to learn from them. So my final words. Did the Plenary Council address all the issues raised in the listening and dialogue process? And I have to say, no, it didn't, but it went some of the way. The motions are not perfect. There are still many issues to discuss. However, within the minimal time frame, it was a good outcome. I think the journey and the process set us a really good example, how we can do things, how we can move together, move forward together. It did embrace the call for walking a synodal path, and in that sense, it was formed by synodality. And for these reasons, I actually believe that it was a pivotal moment in the life of the church. And I'm very grateful for the privilege I had as being a participant in that journey. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Helen. There's an enormous amount in that. So let's, Anne Power.
Thank you very much, Helen. That was a very full and rich account of your experience. One of the things that you mentioned fairly early in your presentation was that participants had to share something of their lived experience which had changed them. I wondered whether or not you would feel comfortable sharing what you presented to other people.
Well, I don't know that I actually presented something as such. However, I think what I took into the discussions to the sessions, to the events that I was engaged in, is I'm a cynic. I come with a cynical lens. And what I had to do is to step back and rethink that cynicism. Because the cynicism, I think, was then leading me to be judgmental. I don't pretend that I've overcome this yet. But I've tried to learn through this process the value of listening to others, to understanding, I may not agree with what you are saying, but you have something to say that is of value. And I think that was one of the things that was really interesting about the disruption on day 3 of the Second Assembly, is on the Tuesday, the second day, the fault lines within the assembly were starting to become very evident. So those, for want of a better word, the fault lines between what you would say is the conservative versus the progressive arms of the church. And some of the discussion took on that flavour, was taking on that flavour, to the extent that we weren't really listening to and hearing each other and respecting people's positions. So that's a lesson that I've had to learn, is to step back. In terms of the final redrafting of Part 4, and I thought this was really significant, one of the motions was talking about the experiences of women who are mothers, who take care of the church, provide the baking, you know, all those sorts of things, versus those women that were looking for a more active role in the decision-making processes of the church. So the document had, say, was actually making a distinction between two groups of women. One of the women got up and said, "I don't want to divide women. Can we reword this?" So the rewording then was, sometimes women are joyful, sometimes women are frustrated. So it was a way of hearing people's experience, but coming up with a solution or an approach that that acknowledged that diversity. So, and I don't know whether that answers the question, but that's probably where, yeah.
That's interesting, Helen, because as many people here would know, Christopher Lamb, the Vatican correspondent for the Tablet, came to Australia specifically to witness and write about the council. And he said to me, I was a bit cynical like you, I suppose, perhaps for different reasons, and I think it comes with the Australian personality. And he made the point that looking at it from an outsider's perspective, he was very positive about it, because he said, when you're dealing with a relatively small population and it's always people you know, you always tend to look on the bad side or be judgmental. And he said, looking at it from the outside, he said, this couldn't happen in England or America. And that was the first thing he said to me. So it doesn't matter what you say, you're doing something important. The other thing was that he said he was very struck by one matter of the organisation. I'd be interested in what you had to say about this. One aspect of the organisation. I'd be interested in what you say about this. He said, I've been to many councils and meetings of the church, and it's like Parliament. The pros are on one side and the nays are on the other. But this situation of having everybody at tables, which were mixed, meant that you had to deal with people. Mm. And he was very positive about that.
I think that's true, John. Is that because we, and if we were truly engaging in spiritual conversations, we had to stop and listen to what people were saying. So it wasn't, you know, you jumping in to actually to propose your particular point of view. It definitely was of value. And Christopher Lamb wasn't alone in making that comment about the council. We had observers. We had Cardinal Dew from New Zealand, Cardinal, I think I'm going to say Bo, but I'm not sure whether that's right, from the Asian Bishops Conference. He was there. We had the nuncio, the papal nuncio, as observers. But we also had the president of the Community of Christian Churches. And each of they gave a little summary at the end, and they were all positive. They were all positive. But as I said, I think it was day three that really did it. I'm not so sure it would have been as positive if we hadn't had day three. And that was the catalyst for people better engaging with each other. And you could feel, you could almost touch the friendliness and the amiability. Not that it was awful before that particular event, but that just washed out a whole lot of things, because the process was stopped, the agenda was stopped, we revisited the format of spiritual conversations. And whilst I'm now a convert to spiritual conversations, I think you've got to be really clear in your mind how you're going to use them. So instead of having three sessions at the table, we had one session at the table. Then it was opened up to the whole assembly, so people from tables could get up and speak to the whole assembly. And then a vote was taken or a decision was taken around a motion. What that did is it meant that the interventions were specific to that motion, not actually foreign or outside the motion. Because what happened on day two around the women part is it got tied up with the female diaconate. Now, and in many ways that was a bit disingenuous because the motions, there was a part of one of the motions about that, but that wasn't the entirety of the thing. But because we didn't have that really tight process, unfortunately it got tied up with that female diaconate. I don't want to be ordained. I freely declare that, but I know women who believe they are called to be ordained. My question then is, why should gender preclude them from that particular ministry? I think some people were there to save the church from itself, but ultimately I think we were saved from ourselves. And that's, I think, was the influence of the Spirit.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you very much, Helen. You've talked about spiritual conversations a lot of times. Is that different from a conversation which is synodal in the way it's managed?
Yeah, I think it's got various names. So contemplative dialogue, spiritual conversations, the Ignatian way of praying. It's essentially about prayer, taking the time to reflect on prayer. What is the Spirit saying to me? Giving everybody around the table an opportunity to voice their thoughts uninterrupted, and that's I think is really important. Then to come back and say, in my prayers today, I heard the group say, or the group, and then the third round was about the decision. So yes, essentially it's about, I suppose, grounding ourselves in prayer, grounding ourselves in listening to the Spirit, but importantly grounding ourselves to listening and hearing what others are saying. It was interesting. We had I actually felt particularly blessed because our diocese is undertaking a synod, and we'd been using some of this process ourselves. So I had a bit of a background that I thought was of assistance. We had a synod working party meeting last week, and we used that particular style of conversation to come to some decisions about how we were going to move forward. Now, we can't actually move forward too much because we haven't got a bishop at the moment, but we can still do a bit of work in this particular space. So I think it can be used in a variety of settings, be they business, be they pastoral, whatever, to get people to step back and think so we're not at loggerheads with each other.
Helen, I too would like to thank you for your excellent presentation. In a very complex lot of things you've had to report on, you've done it brilliantly, so thank you very much. And I hope I really don't have a question, but I've got a comment, and I hope it's not trivial, but I think really we're seeing history in the making, and that came through very strongly as you were presenting the your report.
Thanks, Jeff. Look, I don't think we can go backwards. If we do go backwards, then we've lost the plot. And many people will say we've lost the plot anyway, but if we're going to fulfil God's mission, then we need to adopt a process that the Spirit is guider. I can see no other way forward.
That comment was very interesting because I think it's a part of the Australian characteristic, apart from being cynical. Yet she'll be right, mate. But they will all be ruined, said Hanrahan, is also part of us. And that means that we often don't understand how significant what we do can be. And I've had that experience. One of the things I've learnt in all the time I've worked overseas and gone to conferences overseas is that we are held in very high regard intellectually. And I can remember during the so-called Catholic wrap-up week of the Royal Commission, one of the visitors said to me, "You don't underestimate how important this process is. The world is watching."
And that was true of the, definitely true of the Plenary Council. I think it was Christopher Lambert, don't quote me on this, is basically said, along, or one of the reporters anyway, the journalist said, the Australian Plenary Council has been flying under the radar. And in fact, it is amazing what actually happened in Australia. And I have to say, in no small measure, was that due to the bishops, to the steering committee, to the drafting committee, to the coordinating committee, to the staff who actually carried us through on the journey. It's also due to the input of the members, but more importantly, it was due to the input of all those Australian Catholics who decided they had something to say and wanted to say it. And they did.
Thank you, Helen. That was a wonderful presentation. My question is, it looks like from what you've said that we won't get any feedback from the Vatican for quite some time. It could be 12 months even. We'll lose a lot of impetus if we just sit around and wait for that. So can you perhaps suggest some ideas? What should people like ourselves be doing, can we do in the meantime to keep the whole process alive?
Look, thanks, Trish. I think this is where it's really important that it's now up to local churches to do something, to local churches and agencies. We can't rely on the ACBC to do this. We have to produce a report in 2023. We have to report another report in 25 and the final report in 2027. So it's not going away. You know, dioceses and parishes have to actually undertake some actions. I'm very pleased to say that out of the process itself, some dioceses are already moving to institute their own synods. So Perth is, Ballarat is, we're already undertaking that particular process. But several dioceses are already looking to hold synods. So there is impetus that's actually come out of the whole process. And I think the involvement in dioceses has been patchy. So, for example, if I look in my own region, pastoral region, I was a member and I was a member, lived in that community. But coming up to the Plenary Council, there was no mention of it, you know, in the weeks before. So our history is patchy. So I think that we basically have to keep grinding the grindstone or the millstone. I know that's frustrating, but there are motions that talk about creating practices, synodal practices for the way agencies operate. There's nothing to say that those agencies can not take those up. I think we can learn a lot from our religious sisters and brothers, because I think, to be fair, you're not unfamiliar with this particular way of operating. I'm a bit sort of brain dead at the moment, but I do think that as long as we keep insisting that we adopt synodal practices, that we all our parishes have pastoral councils, that we look to accountability and transparency, that we invite our schools into the conversation, because we know that our pews are all this colour, virtually. But there's a lot going on in schools. But what do we know about is what's happening in schools? They may not be in our pews, but that doesn't mean that they're not actually being Christian, living a mission. So what are we doing that attracts people in, not the other way around? So it's a mindset change too, I think. I don't know whether that helps, Trish.
That question reminded me of something that I was going to observe. You've used a lot of Latin terminology in the presentation, and the Latin phrase which comes to mind is festina lente, hurry slowly, never do anything in a hurry, preferably never do anything at all. So this was a refutation of that.
Yes.
But once you put it into a bureaucracy, and it doesn't matter whether it's a secular bureaucracy or an ecclesial bureaucracy, things tend to die. So that, what you're saying is very important.
Well, can I just say, John, one of the things that did strike me, I met a lot of bishops throughout the assembly, and many of them impressed me because they were wanting to come on this journey. Day three shocked them, but it shocked everybody. I don't think that they're unwilling to do something. We just have to help them do it. And look, Anne's book on synodal leadership is a really good book to start with, to think about how we actually go on this particular journey.
And that book is Leadership in a Synodal Church by Anne Benjamin and Charles Burford, Garrett Publishing, 2021.
Any other questions or comments? If not, I'll leave people to continue to discuss for a long time, I think, what Helen has said. And I thank her very much on behalf of the Society.
Thank you, John.
We've been listening to Dr. Helen Belcher, co-chair of the Maitland-Newcastle Diocesan Pastoral Council, reflecting on the synodal path of the Fifth Plenary Council of Australia. The Q&A which followed was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. It all took place on Sunday, the 14th of August, 2022, in the crypt of the Parish Church of St. Patrick, Churchill, Sydney, Australia. This ACHS podcast was made on the traditional lands of the Gadigal and Wattamedigal peoples of the Eora Nation. There'll be another history talk on the afternoon of Sunday, the 18th of September, 2022, when Dr. John Luttrell will speak about Champagnat Marists in Australia, 1872 to 2022. We look forward to having you along for that talk. Until then, please stay well. The ACHS podcast is produced by me, John Kenny. Bye for now.